and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And I'm Jim Ford.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 609.
That's right. What are we talking about tonight?
What are we talking about, Jim?
Superman.
Yeah. That's it.
That's it. Just we're going to discuss the character in general.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
And this 10-hour episode is sponsored by...
Well, I'm glad I could help out, guys.
Thanks for coming. We'll see you next time.
Brought to you by Z-Quel.
I definitely wasn't asleep on the couch 5 minutes before this episode started.
Oh, God.
The Superman movie.
Yes.
It's out.
It is. And I saw a movie in theaters again. It's within what, a couple of weeks of each other? Holy
and
crap.
I know you're using up your 2020s. Your 2020s quota all in like 1 month.
Well, I'll also be seeing FF, so.
Oh, that's right. What a month. That's right. July is one hell of a year for Chad when it comes to movie going.
All right, where do we want to start? Should we start with Green Lantern or should we start?
No, I think we should start with Green Lantern. That's the most, realistically speaking, that's the most important thing in all of this for us, really, at the end of the day.
Okay.
Spoilers.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Full spoilers.
Yeah, we're dedicating we're dedicating an entire episode to this movie. So, yes, of course, there's going to be spoilers.
Yes.
To be absolutely frank, I had some trepidation going into how Nathan would do with it. Partly his age, partly the costume, partly, you know, various different things we've talked in the lead up to this film. But I thought he fucking nailed it. Whether we're talking the portrayal by Nathan or the writing done by the scripting team. Did James Gunn exclusively script this or did he have a team?
Probably. I believe
okay.
so.
Or the writing then by James Gunn. Especially that last... Look, I am not usually the... you know, cheer in the theater or clap or whatever kind of person during a film. But as soon as guy showed up and saved that kid and started going ham on all the soldiers, I was clapping in that theater because yes, guy is an asshole. He's an asshole with a heart of gold. He's not going to stand by and let somebody be wronged like that in such an obvious way. And the fact that, you know, Superman asked for help or stuff, that whether that plays a factor or not, I don't care. That whole sequence I loved. And I do love, like, you know, you think there's a little bit of bravado in his voice when he started talking with the Justice Gang and Lois about his oath or whatever. But I still got the sense that even with all that, he still takes his job very seriously. And from what I have come to, like, obviously starting off as a Green Lantern fan, I didn't really appreciate Guy. And then we got in the Green Lantern Corps series with Tomasi and them, and I started appreciating him more. And then by Red Lanterns and Emerald Warriors, was it?
Not in that order, but you were correct.
Yeah. My appreciation for Guy Gardner was solidified. And I have... In terms of Guy Gardner's characterization, no notes.
I think the thing that was really good about this, and you're right, when you're talking about Guy, that it reminds me one of my favorite Jimmy Connors quotes about himself is like, "Yeah, I'm an asshole, but I'm a happy asshole." And that's how I kind of see Guy. It's like Guy kind of knows who he is and he's comfortable in his own skin to a large extent. But as much, but to be honest, Tony, walking it back a little, he was, you know, we didn't get complete douchebag Guy Gardner in this. He had an attitude. He had bravado. He had the Guy Gardner smugness to him, but he wasn't a total, he wasn't inherently unlikable.
He wasn't JLI guy.
No, yes, absolutely. Yeah. He wasn't a jerk. And probably in a way, the quintessential proof of that, which would have been really easy to go in the opposite direction to make him one, is when Lois is there trying at the Hall of Justice, they are trying to get everybody to join in to rescue Superman. And he openly acknowledges, he goes, do I really think Superman's here to, you know, to take over the world and rule us? It's like, no, probably not. But the point that he raised was, well, but if he is, that's exactly what I'm supposed to be fighting against as a member of the Green Lantern Corps. So his points were completely valid. And he wasn't drinking he heard bad press and all of a sudden he flipped the switch on Superman when they clearly all of them have an established relationship going on here. So I did appreciate the fact that we had, even though they gave him the bowl cut, this was kind of like post bowl cut Guy Gardner to a large extent, I think, attitude wise, but a little bit of that bowl cut era attitude too. But I do think, and when it came to this, James Gunn did kind of like nail it.
I think they made him kind of the comedy relief, but not in a way that it wasn't at the cost of his character. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because they very easily could have crossed the line and just made Guy a joke. And then you're laughing at him, but you don't really care about him. What they did, like you guys said, they made him more likable. He does a good job. He wants to do a good job. He has that same Guy bravado. He's full of himself, but he is still a hero at the end of the day. And so you feel good laughing at him, but also it's like, yeah, no, he's a pretty good guy. He's that guy in like a group of friends where, yeah, he may screw up every once in a while, but he's got a heart of gold, and that's why we keep him around. I thought that it was like a pitch perfect performance, like you guys said, between the writing, between the acting, it was perfect. I could not have imagined a better Guy Gardner in a movie.
Yeah, the only better Guy Gardner would be one that looks more like Guy or was younger or whatever. Like, in terms of what we were working with, no notes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality. I mean, let's be honest, compared to everybody else, Nathan Fillion's almost like a young whippersnapper to compare to some of the other geriatric lanterns we're going to be getting. And I think, and it makes sense James Gunn took this approach when it came to Guy, because let's be honest, our least favorite Green Lantern, Ryan Reynolds, has done enough to make Green Lantern a joke for the past, you know, 10 plus almost 15 years. That it would absolutely be shooting yourself in the foot to come out in the first time we actually get to see a Green Lantern again on screen to just do the same thing and make this character a complete utter joke, be not only not likable but be just like a moron, and everybody just has complete disdain for him and no respect for the character, because then it's just like, okay, you just good way to revisit the material.
yeah pretty much. Yeah, no, when they went to go fight in the whatever country, and he's got the hands coming up with the middle finger, like I was laughing in the theater at that.
You know, and it's not just that. It's because we talked about this when we're talking about trailers, because we get the whole sequence now. The fact, again, I have to emphasize the fact that he's not like, every time I think, like, let's say the multiverse is real and a Green Lantern ring somehow shows up on one of our fingers one day in the future, what would our first experience trying to use the ring actually physically look like? I'm picturing my fists clenched. I'm picturing like laser focus on the ring. I'm picturing my arm shaking, trying to force it to work, a real, you know, gritting my teeth or something. And he's not even looking at the soldiers. He is waving his hand as if he's casting a spell, just, you know, dismissively, and massive constructs are coming up out of the ground and knocking people for a loop. So, like, the fact that it's effortless for him was so impressive, too.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely adds to how competent he is. Oh, yeah, okay, he's not a complete joke. Like, he is capable. He's very capable.
The sequence with the kaiju, too, in juxtaposition for that, because he, like, you know, the kaiju is a bigger threat. You know, he's just dealing with soldiers. He's with his own actions, he's saying, you're nothing. You're flies to me. Like, much in the same way, like, some feats of strength performed by Superman, which we'll obviously get to later on in the discussion, you know, are very comic booky and show, like, you know, the level of power or whatever. This is like a display of power. Because, you know, dealing with human problems like this is nothing. You've got guns. Great. I've got the most powerful weapon in the universe on my finger, and it takes me nothing to use it right now. But the kaiju, you know, he couldn't get, you know, the oven mitts wouldn't stay on. He tried to put the muzzle on, you know, like there's different factors at play there. And you could even visually see the difference in that, in the way he worked the ring. He was a little bit more intentional with it, a little bit more concentrated, trying different things, you know, getting knocked for a loop, flying back around. Like, so, like, I again, when I'm talking about, and hey, even in the background of that scene where Superman is talking to Lois and they're fighting the interdimensional thing and he creates the baseball bat and whacks it on the head. Like, every piece of Guy Gardner in this, I was very impressed by. And let's just really quick before I forget it, the whole scene when he goes to the other country with Metamorpho and Hawkgirl, including when he's sitting in the diner watching what's happening on the news, and you see him take that pause and think as he's chewing his bite, all of it I loved.
And you had to love when the kid's still waiting for Superman to show up, who of course he's not showing up, and he goes, Superman's busy, but he asked us to help, so you got an upgrade. Now that's like prototypical Guy Gardner right there. It's like, yeah, you wanted Superman, but you got a better deal. It's like you got the even better version of it. Us.
Oh. Man, the thing we were Metamorpho at the end is like, oh, what a cool name. Oh, you're in,
yes. And he needs another vote on his side, so that's why.
I'm just shocked somebody made him the leader.
Well, it does make you wonder it does seem on the surface he actually is, but it also makes you wonder if it's like one of those things where, you know, we let Guy think he's the leader because it makes him happy and it's going to keep him quiet. But at the end of the day, I mean,
I imagine Michael Holt is probably busy with his own company outside of his secret identity and then running all the data. And then Hawkgirl, I don't think Hawkgirl gives shit.
Yeah.
No, not that
he's probably leader by default, or Lord is the one who picked him to be leader.
That's true, because it'd be easier to control potentially, or wouldn't ask too many questions. But they really didn't give Isabella much to do with Hawkgirl. But I agree that they kind of do establish a little nice rapport between Guy Gardner and Hawkgirl, which would make sense since obviously they both are showing up in Peacemaker anyway. But I mean, they do kind of have this, even though they don't really have that much dialogue between the two of them, you kind of see that they do kind of like push each other's buttons in a different kind of way. So I think that also works. It would have been nice if they gave Isabella Merced a little bit more to do, but somebody had to get shafted when it came to that. So you kind of knew Hawkgirl all along was the most likely one.
Yeah, using Guy as a springboard to other topics and the Justice Gang and stuff like that. I will go following that lead with Hawkgirl. When she first came in and started doing the scream, I was like, oh, interesting choice. But that very quickly grew on me. I liked that. The Hawk scream that she does every time she's flying around and stuff like that, or taking a swing with her mace or whatever. That was awesome. I got to say, I even liked the detail in her. Did you guys pay attention to the detail in her apartment when she was watching the news? about what was happening in that other country. She's got archaeological shit all over her apartment. I mean, just so much attention to detail, and there's lots of it throughout this movie, but that was one of them. And also, and I've been thinking about this for a little while now, because I, you know, have been, as you guys know, going out and buying Guy Gardner merchandise from the movie to review on our YouTube channel. So I've been, you know, seeing the actual costumes a lot in person quite a bit. I think Hawk Girl's costume of the Justice Game might be my favorite of all three of them. I just really like the colors. It's different. It stands out. Now, obviously, you got the Justice Gang symbol or whatever, the Maxwell Lord symbol on all of their chests. So I could do without that on every one of them. But design wise, Hawk Girls, I thought it was great. The whole I'm thinking we're going to see consequences for her killing a state official in future stuff. Maybe something like Peacemaker. I don't know. But I didn't have a problem with her killing him, not just because he was a bad dude. I think that too is in character, especially for a Hawk.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was a bold choice, and it establishes that in this universe, there are heroes that kill. Superman not being one of them, but they definitely, you know, there are heroes that kill.
Yeah, I think it's important to show the differentiation between the characters and their values. And and you're probably right, Chad. It's setting up a DC Civil War like in 5 years.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Also, speaking of the costume design, I love how, like, I didn't even question the Hawk helmet. With live action Hawk, you know, Hawkman or Hawkwoman interpretations, the helmet is always such a thing to think about, usually for Hawkman, because it's, you know, it's a much more pronounced beak. The wings are sticking more straight up. It's crazy looking. The costuming here was done so well, and it fit her face so well. I didn't even clock it watching the film.
I wonder how much more of her performance there was before the final cuts.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously you can't give everybody equal time. And like you said, somebody's going to get the shaft. But when you come away from that movie, you do notice how little she was used. Not even something that you are looking for, but you definitely take that away. So I wonder if she just had the stuff that was easiest to cut, and with the idea that in a future movie, she'll get more focus or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. Terrific?
Yes, the movie was.
Boy. Now, he missed a terrific was really good. He kind of, if Guy didn't steal the movie, he probably did for the most part. He had a huge role to play on, not just on screen, but not just plot wise either. But he did kind of steal. I think he did kind of, and not in a negative way, but he did kind of, he probably from more than most people would have suspected that he had a hell of a lot of screen time.
Yeah. And the garage door sequence. Yeah.
Something everybody can relate to. It's like, can't the damn door go up and down faster? It's like, we know there's a failsafe, so if something walks underneath her, it'll stop. But I mean, but when you're in a hurry, there's nothing worse than that. It's like, come on, risers close faster. Usually rising like that because you want to get in and get out.
I just like the brilliance in either directing or writing or whatever, that timing plays in a joke like that. Because the whole point of the joke is you have to find that right balance of, okay, this is funny. Okay, this is going on too long. And then it loops back around to being funny again. That's the window where it's a great joke, is that loop back around part. And that was timed out just perfectly enough. It was weird. I was like, it was a total pause in the action. We were just watching this stupid door open. I was like, okay, this is happening a little bit too long. And then it got funnier again. And I was like, that's perfect.
It's like Star-Lord in Nebula with the car door in Guardians 3.
Open the fucking door. really great. I mean, the interpretation of the tech. I've seen a lot of people on social media can do this comparison already. And I think I even saw some interviewers during the press junket, during the parts where the press had already seen the film and were doing follow-up interviews with James Gunn and them. They were talking about how Terrific's fight with his T-spheres is very similar to Yondu's fights with his little whistle thing. And he was like, yeah, somebody, the interviewer he spoke to was like, yeah, nobody's asked me about that. And he was talking about how, like, yes, there's lots of comparison to it. And they had to work with a choreographer or something to figure out the right hand movements and stuff like that to get everything. So, yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely a cool scene. But as it was happening, it's like, oh, this is Yondu all over again.
Yeah.
This is definitely a hallmark of James Gunn. It wasn't bad, but you know, like it was cool, and you had the force field aspect also.
Lois's POV,
and him like grabbing onto the sphere and then like rotating around while you know hovering, holding onto the sphere. That was cool.
I'm Mary Poppins, y'all. It was crazy, but also again characterization, very no nonsense, and also a without being an ass about it, an air of I'm surrounded by idiots.
Out of all the characters, Mr. Terrific is definitely either the favorite of my son Scott or one of the favorites, because as far as the action figures go, he loves Mr. Terrific.
Yeah, for sure. Metamorpho?
Certainly looked the part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe not have acted necessarily the part character-wise, but I would say he looked the part, obviously.
Character-wise, it was not Metamorpho.
No.
No.
I wonder how early he is in his transformation, though. The fact that he's already has a baby that's impacted by his genetic change, though, that probably doesn't lend credence to it being too particularly early in his time as Metamorpho.
In this universe, he's very timid, very nervous about who he is, about his powers, whereas the comic version, he's way more like he was an explorer. He was the one that was going after, you know, these powers, and not that he was going after the powers, but he was, you know, getting into Egyptian crypts and things like that. He was an adventurer. This character was not an adventurer. Now, I don't have enough ties to Metamorpho as a character to really care or not. So if that's how you want to make the character to facilitate the plot and move everything along, I don't have a problem with it. But I feel like if you were a diehard Metamorpho fan, this probably isn't your ideal scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. But that's kind of why I asked how early he was in his mutation, because there was a part immediately after he changed it, not in all interpretations, but definitely like the JLU version and stuff like that, where Metamorpho was like, you know, this man, this monster, and don't let Sapphire see me, and like, you know, very unsure of himself and scared of how the world would react to him. So, but again, the fact that they already have a child together that's affected by it, I don't know. Which, by the way, felt almost kind of wasted. That whole point of there being a son, it's almost like you could just, Lex could have kidnapped Sapphire instead. Why did we have, and again, lends credence to the question you asked earlier, Jim, about like how much of this movie was cut. Was there more with Baby Joey? Because there's even figures of Baby Joey. You know, how much more was there? Like, you know, one of the toys also features like an abominable snow type monster that was supposed to be somewhere around the fortress area.
Yes,
but we never. Yeah, so we never saw that either. So, you know, how much Baby Joey was there? Maybe there was more point to him being there other than just motivation for keeping Metamorpho in check.
I don't know how much more Baby Joey you could have had in that movie. Although I will say that the amount of Baby Joey that we got, the rest of my family refers to Metamorpho as Joey's dad. So, you know, the impact of Baby Joey was significantly felt. He, Scott, my youngest son, he has he got the first birthday, the whole set of the Target exclusive set.
Yeah.
So it comes with like a bunch of the figures.
And then Crypto and Joey.
Set. Yes.
Yeah.
So he gets to play with Baby Joey and Metamorpho all the time, and he's loving that. I haven't seen the big Baby Joey.
Yeah. The McFarlane one that's almost in like a Funko shaped box.
Something like that. So I don't even know if my son would want that.
It's usually in the back wall of Target where all the more exclusive collectibles are.
We check that too.
Okay.
Like we always check that. Like we check all the sections. But yeah, no. Regardless, I don't know if it's because it's not, if it's selling well and it, we just haven't seen it, or if they haven't put it out yet, or I don't know how well it would be received, but my impression is that that character was received really well in the movie, and I feel like he was definitely put there to sell toys, which makes sense. You know, you gotta push toys, so why not? I don't know how much more they could have done with the baby though. Like,
yeah, I will say too, specific to Metamorpho, I don't have any particular issues with how people's powers were portrayed in this movie, and I think Metamorpho is a great example of this, because at one point they let his whole body just go gaseous and he was like a floppy floating head, which looked ridiculous. But again, that's how his powers effing function. So like, I love that they didn't just go, okay, well, this looks a little ridiculous, we need a little change here visually. No, that's how his powers function. It would look stupid. Let's just go with it. So I thought that was cool. It was weird. It was otherworldly, but it's meant to be weird and otherworldly. So they just freaking leaned into it.
Baby Joey, $20 on Big Bad Toy Store, Jim.
I'll keep that in mind in case my son asks for it.
$19.99. In stock.
You know, this is a minor quibble, and it's with the action figures. But this is as good a point to mention it. It bothers me when you have the option to buy each individual figure and collect a piece to get number four versus buying a box set where the box set is the only way to get Lex Luthor, Baby Joey, and Crypto. And then no parts whatsoever to build your robot. So as it is, we have the box set, and then I went out and I got the engineer so that he had another villain to play with. And eventually, I'm sure that we'll get Hawkgirl and Green Lantern if we see them. So we're going to have three pieces of the robot, and that's it, because we already got the figures. They can't expect, like, how many people are going to buy two of each figure just to get the robot and Lex Luthor and Baby Joey and Crypto? It's irritating. This is not the first movie where it's been done. They've been doing this for a very, very long time. It's just, it's one of those pet peeves that I figured I'd throw out there right now since we're talking about toys.
I agree.
They don't make it easy.
No, they don't.
To the point of the Abominable Snowman, I was just reading actually earlier this evening about how there was a scene where when Crypto was dragging Superman back to the Fortress of Solitude, they're passing a bunch of dead Abominable Snowmen in the snow. And Superman's like yelling at Crypto. It's like, you have to stop killing the Abominable Snowmen. And it tested so poorly that that's why they cut it out.
Oh.
So.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, you can't even say there's a fine line. There's a pretty distinct line between just being a bull in a china shop and being careless and causing non-fatal damage to different and to replaceable things, as opposed to, oh yeah, it's like because his owners are drunk, he has this real problem with listening to anybody, and he kind of kills anything, even though they kind of gave you the impression of that concept anyway when Clark said he had to take the dog away from us farm because he was afraid he was going to kill Pa Kent's cows. So I guess they got, but in the movie it almost comes across as, oh, he's just kind of kidding around. So but we had seen him already kill before. It's like, oh, he's, no pun intended, he's dead serious, he's going to kill every animal on this farm.
He's got a taste for blood.
That's right. Put him down.
Yeti murder.
Jim, there is a Superman robot McFarlane figure. So in terms of getting the kids a robot, there is one of the, it's one of the deluxe edition, like collector's edition, that, and it's like one of the platinum figures that are harder to find.
Yeah, definitely not. That's not going to happen because of scale.
I think, if it's because of scale, because I also think that those 12-inch figures, the more bulky, like less articulation ones that are like $10, I think there's supposed to be a Superman robot of that as well.
That's really cool if they did that. I haven't seen or heard that. I actually would have gone for that, but, you know, because there's a bigger selection of characters in the 5 or 6 inch line. Yeah. That's kind of what we're going with. Although he also has the superpowers Superman from the movie, just because that one's a little bit smaller and, you know, more handheld kind of thing.
I've only seen one picture of the Spin Master 12 inch though, so I'm not entirely sure if that's right or not. So, but yeah.
Cool.
All right, let's get into the movie itself then.
Which movie?
Casting was good, which would be expected because that's one of James Gunn's strengths.
Yeah.
I can't really think of anybody who's horribly miscast in this movie at all. So I think
I can.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. You're right. We can delve into that or just wait to do the parents plural in its own little mini segment. But you're right. I agree with you. I think Ma and Pa Kent were horribly miscast. But I thought that I kind of thought that all along. I never bought into it when I first heard and I first saw it in the trailer. I didn't think it was going to work, and it does. And to me, it doesn't absolutely at all. Most of the other things that were questionable, like Miss Tess Mocker, it's how it's written. It's not necessarily how it's cast. I mean, it's how she's written.
I thought that she did a decent job with what she was given. I didn't have any major issues because that is her character.
Yeah, Valerie Perrine's character had a little bit more going on, I think, behind the scenes. She had a little bit more, I think, under the hood going on. I just think they didn't make Eve come across as particularly bright and fawning all over Jimmy, which is another thing we could potentially talk about if we have time in general. But I guess since you did give me the segue, the biggest issue I have with the movie is across the board is what James Gunn decided to do with the parents in this movie. I said jokingly, even though there is a slight difference, because if this was really Rob Zombie Superman, they would be white trash parents as opposed to just being country bumpkins, which they are. But making them so bumpkin-like, I know it's not unrealistic to have that happen. And to have parents who just seem like, or not that there's anything wrong with that anyway. So I think attacking them as the quality of human beings, but to have those parents basically beget that son, it's possible it does happen, but it goes so far against what we've seen historically. Jonathan and Martha Kent represented as, it's kind of was a bitter pill.
I don't think that aspect, the them being country bumpkins. I think they definitely played it up in this movie, but that's not what I had a huge issue with. To me, like you said, as soon as they cast those people, it just felt off. It just felt off. They didn't feel like Ma and Pa Kent. They definitely didn't look like Ma and Pa Kent, and they didn't have the feel of Ma and Pa Kent. But you know what? I said, it's James Gunn, got to trust the process, whatever. He's usually pretty great about this stuff. And then when we get the chemistry between them was nothing. There was nothing there. The parents were doing the best that they could, and Superman is doing the best that they could, but there was zero chemistry. They did not feel the father. I felt there was a little bit more of a connection.
Well, yeah, because he has that one important scene with Clark that makes which we saw in the trailer, of course. But the point was that's it.
But that was almost heavy handed. It was necessary for the scene, but that was the only bit where it's like, okay, well, you feel the connection. When she's like, you know, I cleaned your suit and I cleaned your boots or whatever, like, it felt like that could have been his dry cleaner. Like, there was no emotional connection there. And I understand also the fact that you've got Superman being, like, emotionally distant because he's processing a lot with his birth parents, but that's to the detriment of the connection with his Earth parents, where it really should have been a lot more close-knit to produce the Superman that we're watching in that movie.
I do agree with that. I guess deep down it's kind of hard for me to judge how much I hold it against, because they just come across as the bumpkin. But that may just be the icing on the cake, as far as it just seems like the whole how they decided to make the parents and their relationship with Clark be so different that I guess it is kind of hard to know which one was kind of like stuck in my craw more when it came to that. But that's a sliding scale compared to what they did to Jor-El and Lara. That's kind of nothing.
Oh, sorry. I didn't.
Go ahead. No, you say what you go. Do you fit? You say what you want to say about Jonathan and Martha before we get into the big thing.
I can see what you guys are saying. From my perspective, I didn't necessarily feel like John and Martha were particularly perfectly cast or perfectly executed or whatever. There wasn't really enough of them on screen for that, other than Jonathan's speech to Clark. But beyond that, my problem with the parents wasn't necessarily the actors or the way they were portrayed. It was the relationship with Clark, not necessarily even when he's face to face. Clark looking annoyed or impatient while he was talking to his mother on the phone or ignoring her phone calls. There were, I forget when they particularly happened in terms of what else was going on, but there was one moment where it was happening, and it might have been the conversation where, like, she's like leaning over the coffee table and yelling into the phone or whatever.
Don't be a stranger, that conversation.
Yeah, that conversation.
Yeah.
He seemed particularly just irritated at the fact they were calling, which didn't feel like Clark's relationship with his parents. That particular instance is the thing that I felt was the most against what his relationship with his parents should be like. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a very big introvert. When my own mother calls sometimes, or to be very fair, when anybody, my mother, my sister, my dad, when anybody gives me a call, there is this moment of where I'm just like, I got to talk to somebody. And I do. Yeah. It's not even the fact that I have to talk to them. It's just, I have to talk to somebody, and I'm in my moment. I'm eating something or whatever. I'm doing my solitude thing. And, my peace has been interrupted, but I'm never like, oh my God, that person, or I never let it, I try very hard not to let it show through to impact my relationships with my family. But it just felt very anti-Clark to be frustrated at this conversation with his parents.
I agree.
I think that's, so it's interesting because in a way we're all picking up on one aspect, but it's all one aspect of a whole, because no matter how we slice it, the relationship between Clark and his parents, no matter where we want to zero in on it, whether we think it's the casting, how they're portrayed, or the specifics in their relationship, that we all kind of picking up on that's a problem. And I think that's fair. I think they were very on Martha and Jonathan, like, and or relate in the relationship between Clark and them seemed very, very, very off. I think that's true. And then clearly the odd decision at best, unless like Jim and I have been talking about, unless at some point James Gunn decides, right, whether he has a plan originally or not, whether he decides to kind of walk it back somehow. The decision to do what they did with Jor-El and Lara just seemed so head scratching from the perspective that we know part of what makes Superman who he is because he's a child of two worlds. And he's trying to walk the line between both because he knows he was born from one but raised in another. But historically speaking, not exclusively, but historically speaking, he's kind of has had good parents on both ends. And by making it seem like, yeah, you know, we're sending you to Earth and we want you to be happy. But by the way, to imply we're only going to be happy with you if you take over the planet and dominate the planet and treat them like they're cattle, have as many kids as possible, spread the, you know, basically make new Krypton on Earth, kind of like the, almost like a Zod kind of thing. It just seems so odd to go down that road with that. It just seemed, I mean, yes, there's a thousand different ways they could walk it back in multiple ways without even not one of them is not the whole, oh, well, Lex fixed, you know, they hacked the tape and they altered it. We know that's not the case because he literally beat us over the head with it. And of all people that was going to admit it, at some point Lex would have admitted it just because Lex is an egomaniac.
Yeah.
The fact that he acknowledged, well, I didn't have to because pretty much the smoking gun was already there. That's not how they can explain it away. There has to be something that happened before it got to Earth. You know, Jim and I have talked. Yes, it could be a Brainiac thing. It could be the Eradicator program doing something. It could be what I thought is that they, Lara and Jor-El, changed their mind themselves, and they did a last minute erasure after they recorded it because they realized this was really horrible to dump on their kid as the pressure to put on him, to make it seem like, well, he's going to be raised by these people and he's going to have to dominate them. Plus, this is the only way we're going to be proud of him or be a true last son of Krypton, is that they may have done it at the last second. And because what are the odds, honestly, objectively, of all the things that come to Earth in that ship, everything survives, but half a recording doesn't. It doesn't make any sense, really, objectively.
I've also heard that it was actually Zod and Feyora.
Which is
less likely for its own reasons, like, you know, yes, the Superman robots maybe not recognizing that it's different, or Kara not saying something. I'm sure he's shown this recording to his cousin at some point in the past, whatever, 3 years or so that he's been active, and we don't know how long he's known about Kara, so maybe even longer. You would assume she might have said something or whatever, but I've heard that that's not actually Jor-El and Lara. Even if it's not, like, even if it is them and it was not Brainiac or whatever, I don't like it necessarily. I don't hate it. I think in terms of Jor-El and Lara, the last time we had a big shift in their characterization was Byrne's Man of Steel stuff, where they were painted to be an emotionless race, and, you know, there wasn't actually a whole lot of love between Jor-El and Lara and stuff like that. So I don't necessarily rail against it. I think they could walk it back. I agree with you. These Man of Two Worlds, the parents, one of the things I love about Smallville is the contentious relationship between Jor-El and Clark at first, but then how the two grow to an understanding with each other. And, you know, his initial message of, you know, rule them or whatever that Clark hears earlier on in that series, you know, actually means, like, you know, show them the way, you know, it's just a different interpretation or whatever. And just the understanding that happens between them. So I do like historically like the connection between Superman and his parents, on the Kryptonian side, but I don't know that this necessarily loses us anything. He's still very curious about his own culture. He still owns the fact that he's an alien from another world. His parents.
It's not like he can't.
Well,
he has to own it because people know it's true.
I don't know that it necessarily loses us anything super significant in terms of what the Superman that we get out of it.
Well, I think it absolutely lessens his tie. It lessens his emotional ties to where he came from, because he will be conflicted because they did send him to Earth. They did save his life and he is doing great things, but it's not because they sent him to Earth hoping he would do great things. Not great things are being interpreted differently to them than what he's thinking. But the point is, it's kind of hard to be proud of where you came from because with all this baggage and Kara's not, and we know it's based on a comic book story, but Kara's not exactly helping the cause either when we see her. So I don't know. I think it makes him borderline a Kryptonian in name only because he's just an Earthling with superpowers. If you by cutting that cord to his parents.
I think that it almost has to be revealed to be something different because the fact that Kara is there. Now, I'm sure that Kara has seen the first half of the message. She hasn't seen the second half because she's been off world. She literally just gets back at the end of that movie. So she has no idea that the second half has been decoded. Now, either it's going to be revealed that it was edited or something like that by a race beyond our understanding to be the only way that nullifies what Mr. Terrific said. Or, probably more likely, the translation is incorrect. And, you know, like you just inferred with the other show, oh, well, you know, they're dumb and, you know, they're a backwards race. You need to rule them. Like, it's like, well, they could just be simple folk, you know, and you need to, like you said, lead the way. And instead of like grow a harem, then maybe they were actually saying you need to find somebody that you connect with, somebody that you love, you know, like him and his wife. It could very well be just a mistranslation problem. And as soon as she sees it, she'll be like, oh, yeah, no, this is what they were actually trying to say. Blah, 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 blah. It completely walks back everything that they did. But you had that scene in this movie where Superman has to question, okay, who am I? What am I doing? Where am I going? What are the choices that I'm making based on this information? So it's kind of like you get to have your cake and eat it too. And I think that we'll probably get this reveal either in another Superman movie or in the Supergirl movie, more likely.
But if the only problem with that is we know the first half of the message was translated correctly because Superman knew it was translated correctly. So they had the first half of the message almost as a guide, as a Rosetta Stone to translate what's going on in the second part. So it could be an inflection thing, perhaps. But I mean, it's not like it's impossible. It could be literally lost in translation, but you pretty much have the first half of the message there for you. And when they retranslated it, if you will, and they showed it to the world, it pretty much is exactly what Superman, what Clark saw. So unless something got, like the first part got translated wrong too, like at the Fortress of Solitude or wherever the hell he first got translated, I think it makes it. The other thing about Kara that makes it interesting is would not her parents want her to pretty much do the same thing?
Exactly.
It's like, have sex with as many people as you want, which she may very well be doing. But the point is, you know, so that is the one part that does leave it open too. I agree, because if this is really the Kryptonian way, then you would think Kara would, because especially since Kara's, if I remember, Kara's historical track record here is that she came to Earth as an adult, more of an adult, but she wasn't raised as a child like Clark was. So she would be more set in knowing the Kryptonian ways to begin with. So we'll have to see. We'll have to see what the Supergirl movie is. Which again, I'm looking. I like Millie Alcock. I don't know how much I'm gonna like this version of Supergirl. At least the one we're gonna get for the first probably three quarters of that movie.
Why she's getting drunk, because she knows what she lost.
The Supergirl of Tomorrow, whatever that storyline that the movie's based on.
Yeah,
it kind of reinforces the fact that she was like 16 years old or whatever when Krypton blew up. And then because of a time dilation, Superman is now older than her, but she knows what she lost. She lost her entire people that she remembers. Mm-hmm. So she would absolutely remember a Jor-El and Lara that were like, yeah, we want our baby to go and conquer the planet. You know, make sure you see him off and make sure he does that well. Like, no, she's going to bring that up at some point.
Yeah, you would think no matter what, there's got to be conversations, and there's got to be at least some more revelation about what's going on. Because if it's completely the antithesis of what she knew those people to be, then you think she would point that out. And if it's not, or at the very least, whether this is pretty much standard operating procedure from a Kryptonian perspective, that this is the majority of how they would view this planet or sending them there. So, yeah. But that's one of those things that is up in the air. But it did bother me a lot what they did with Jor-El and Lara.
Some of the stuff I wanted to touch on, because I don't know how much time we want to go on with this, but I do want to make sure I talk just a bit about the now that we've talked about the kind of the main twist there, I saw this in IMAX, relative IMAX, what they call IMAX, was something that's not necessarily the actual IMAX, you know, massive, you know, several story tall screen. I didn't see it in 3D. I don't know if I like or dislike the aspects of the film that were clearly done in such a way to cater to 3D, like the punch with the tooth coming out, or, you know, things like that. Some of the camera work specifically for something that would work well in 3D, in watching the movie not in 3D, made me feel a little bit like on the nose, but it almost fit in this movie because of the comic booky feel. Because if we remember the feel and or the what not the feel what they actually did in that first Hulk movie, where they were literal comic panels on screen, so some of the on the nose stuff was highlighted and accentuated as being on the nose, and because it was a comic book movie come to life, they literally put the panels on the screen. This felt almost similar without actually putting comic panels on the screen. So I'm not sure if I'm irritated by the 3D aspects or if it just adds to the comic book feel of the movie.
I don't, it didn't take me out of it.
Yeah. I did notice it though. The fact that I clocked it, I was like,
Yeah. Until you just brought it up, I didn't even think about the fact that like the tooth scene would have played better in 3D. It hadn't even occurred to me. So
yeah,
no, it played fine for me.
Mark?
To me, I mean, I didn't have an issue with it. I mean, the reality is, I know this was, there were certain parts, if not the whole movie, with certain parts for, you know, were filmed or made for IMAX, but we know it wasn't filmed in 3D. So because it wasn't filmed in 3D, we kind of know that the 3D would kind of blow it 9 times out of 10 anyway, because that's what 3D does these days, because nobody cares. It's, you know, the pendulum keeps swinging back and forth. So the reality is there. Other than something like Avatar, and even when I went to see Avatar, the last one, that the 3D was, when they did the 3D, it was good, but they didn't do as much of it as I would have thought they would have done. That, yeah, I mean, it probably would have been an interesting movie to see in IMAX, especially the flying sequences and things like that, but...
And it was.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, I guess it's just... The more important thing is, what is the movie on its own? I mean, I guess Avatar, again, is that's the only example, because Avatar arguably wouldn't be anything if you took away the visuals on it, because that's what drives people to go see it.
Yeah.
But I thought overall the story was okay. It wasn't fantastic. I mean, it wasn't earth-shatteringly great, but it was interesting. I liked being dropped into the world that, you know, the 3 years pretty much with Superman being Superman. And I did like the beginning with everything in increments of three years, you know, like the 300 years ago. Yeah. 3 years, 3 minutes, blah, 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 blah. I did like that. The one thing that, regardless of whether you really like the movie, dislike the movie, somewhere in between, one of the things that'd be hard not to agree upon, like how everybody hates Lex Luthor, as he pointed out at the end of the movie. The fact that this is a much better universe or world to live in than the Snyderverse. If you were living on Earth, you'd much rather live in the James Gunn Earth and universe than the Snyderverse.
Yeah.
It is just much more bright, much more hopeful, much more cohesive. There's just more there. And I think on that level, James Gunn absolutely succeeded in digging out of the hole, which wasn't all Zack Snyder's fault. Because it's not like every failure of the DCEU was Zack Snyder's fault. But he did steer them in a really dark, kind of off-putting direction to a certain extent. And his egomaniac tendencies to make everything like, oh, everything I do has to be like 3.5 hours. And all these problems, that kind of helped dig the hole that anytime you were going to try to reboot this universe now, because he never had that trouble. No one had ever done a DC cinematic universe before, so people were interested and people were pumped. James Gunn had to kind of like take out the trash and try to put the pieces back together. So as an opening salvo from a movie perspective, obviously, you know, he's done fine. You know, his Suicide Squad movie in the past universe was fine. Peacemaker was fine. It was good. It should say not fine. That makes it sound like it was just passable. Creature Commandos was much better than it should have been. And this movie, I think he said it, the early dominoes that are falling have been pretty good. So I think that ultimately is the victory, even though we don't know how well financially this will do. We'll have to see. We'll have to see how well it holds this coming weekend. Is it going to hold? Is it going to hold more like Guardians 3, or is it going to hold more like, let's say, Jurassic World Rebirth, which still wasn't bad. I mean, it dropped only 56%. So I actually thought that movie was going to drop more than that. But is it going to hold like close to 50% of its business, or is it going to drop close to 60%? Kind of important with Fantastic Four on the horizon. So, but I thought overall it was successful. It didn't move the needle much for me for where I was going in. I liked most of it. The things I didn't really like were, you know, the thing with his parents, both sets kind of bothered me a lot. So I can only give it so much of a thumbs up, but I enjoyed it.
The thing that I wanted to touch on was with Lex Luthor. I thought that Nicholas Holt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Did a fantastic job. He played an extremely competent, super genius Lex Luthor. And at times, like, somewhat likable a little bit. But the thing that I just loved the most about it was how he had this whole plan to team up with this other country and supply them with arms and weapons like that. And create a continent of Lutherland, like his own kingdom that he was going to rule. So it brings it back to, like, it's all about a land deal. Every Lex Luthor in a movie has to have like a land deal. But the key to it in this movie is that all of that was just a ruse so that he could get away with killing Superman. That to me was like, oh my God. Okay. So yeah, we've got another Lex Luthor who's obsessed with a land deal, but not quite. It's like they were making fun of the fact that they were hanging a lampshade on the fact that that's always what Lex Luthor does. But in this case, it's like, no, that was just a means to an end. And the end is killing Superman. That part I really, really liked.
Yeah, agreed. I thought he did really well. Played an egomaniac very well. A competent egomaniac.
A little emotional, though. You can make a case he was a little emotionally over the top at times.
A little.
Volatile. Mm-hmm. I do think it was a good performance. Again, overall, I thought it was a good performance. I don't know. It would have been nice if we actually would have seen Lex Luthor in the suit, even though obviously his goons are kind of basically wearing his purple suit design. So I guess it's kind of almost like being there. But yeah, I thought. And the Ultraman twist, I think that was fairly. I mean, you pretty much knew the twist once they got into the Fortress of Solitude.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I mean that in a way that was. I mean, he probably wasn't trying to hide that clear. I would say clearly, but it in a way did kind of take away from if you wanted to build up the suspense as to why. And it also, to be fair, it takes away some of the criticism of. Oh, he was getting his ass kicked too much. Well, technically, he was getting his ass kicked almost exclusively by the same person, just in different outfits. But we know why, because he's a clone, so it kind of makes sense. It's a clone of Superman. Yeah. The kaiju was kind of funny because he starts off like Stitch, and then like the next day he's like he's like Godzilla size. It's like, what the hell? Oh, he'll grow. Or he'll get bigger. It's like, yeah, you weren't kidding.
Circling back just real quick to Eve Tessmacher, I don't think she was stupid or anything that we were talking about earlier. But to be very clear, she told Jimmy she had information to bring him down. And what she sent him were the selfies. She knew she had the information in the background of her selfies. Oh, that was intentional.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that if you were going to. To me, that's not the part that kind of made her look.
She's vapid. That's all.
Yes. She was absolutely consciously aware of what she was sending him, or else there wouldn't be the idea of, oh, I have stuff to take down Lex, if she didn't know it was subtly in the, you know, it was subtle. So yes, it shows a level of intelligence because of the fact that she was able to get the smoking gun, capture the smoking gun, but on the surface. You wouldn't notice that it was a smoking gun. You'd have to dig, and only the right people would dig for something like that, and Jimmy would be one of them.
For sure. So, and oh, go ahead.
Okay.
I refuse to end this episode without talking about Rachel Brosnahan as Lois Lane, because aside from maybe Guy or Terrific or whatever, I loved Lois portrayal and writing. I thought, to me, an ideal Lois is a born reporter who could easily be a hero, but she doesn't want to be, and she doesn't have the situation to be one. But she knows who she is. She was born to be a reporter. That's her purpose. She's embraced that, but she has no fear about diving into the fray. And I loved it. I loved what we saw from Rachel Brosnahan as Lois.
I agree. I thought that there was really good chemistry between them. They did screen tests to figure out if they had chemistry, but it's definitely clear on the screen.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, they were very good together, and I think that was important. Corin Sweat was a good Superman, I think, overall. Mm-hmm. Especially based on how he was being written too. Obviously we barely got to see him as Clark's, you know, certainly a professional Clark, so we don't entirely know what Daily Planet Clark is necessarily, you know, what public persona Clark is really like entirely, but you don't need to. That was not what this movie was about. So
we didn't get a lot of them, but I thought Perry White was really good.
Yes.
And Jimmy Olsen, I really like the fact that women are inexplicably just drawn to him. Like, it makes no sense, but it's like, well, it is Jimmy Olsen's, and a lot of things that don't make sense happen to Jimmy Olsen.
For sure. One thing I also wanted to mention is I really like that Malik's sacrifice mattered in the end. At least in terms of, at the very least, in the terms of the article that ends up on the front page in the final sequence of the movie. And I heard, and I think this is correct if I remember right. He told Superman, I don't have any family, you know, don't worry about me, you know, that whole thing. Yes. But didn't he tell his father to look after the falafel stand when we first saw him? So he lied.
I don't know. I don't remember that.
He was lying for the sake of Superman. It doesn't make his sacrifice, you know, worse if that's not true. But it definitely adds an interesting wrinkle if that was true. I have to see the movie again.
I think you're probably right. I think that it sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
No, but it definitely made the character come off as brave. Like, this is a brave sacrifice of somebody who is trying to protect Superman.
Yeah.
Crypto, what'd everybody think?
I like Crypto for the most part. They did. I mean, especially because at least they give you the built-in explanation at the end because of how completely unruly and undisciplined Kara is. That's why Crypto is exactly the same way. No boundaries, yes. as Gary said, no boundaries.
Yeah. I thought I'd have more of a problem with it, but they did enough with the comedy. And he's unruly, but he is loyal. So I think that's enough.
Yeah.
And they were smart to take out the scene of Ultraman punching him. They were smart.
Oh, yeah.
we riot.
So we're talking power levels.
Yep.
Yes.
So there's been obviously, in addition to the you know, Jor-El Lara thing, one of the complaints I've seen about this movie from some people, aside from the Steiner stands, who I don't, you know, track any of their critiques for this film, is that Superman. Well, actually, you know what? Somebody reached out to us over on Twitter looking forward to this episode saying Superman got beat up and had to be rescued too often in his own movie. But otherwise, I like everything about it. Thank you, Anderson, for that. But that's kind of a critique I'm seeing from some people. I don't necessarily buy that. Just because, again, the opening credits Mark talked about earlier established this is the first defeat he's ever suffered. It's at the hands of basically himself, his first equal likely he's ever gone up against. We see what they say, he's at 80-something% right after they fix him up. And then he immediately goes into the kaiju battle, which then leads to the report. And then he turns himself in and is taken away into a dimension with no sun.
whatsoever while he's already not at 100% and then experiences prolonged exposure to kryptonite. And then after escaping, goes back to face himself yet again. So I don't necessarily think his power level was a problem here. By the way, while he was depowered, he somehow managed to fight off a bunch of people in a like antimatter proton, whatever the hell that river was, while holding on to baby Joey and escaping the gravity well of a black hole.
Yes. Well, when he escaped the gravity well, he had some solar energy repaired because of Metamorpho creating a mini sun almost for him.
Right, but even after that, he was big, he could barely stand.
Well, he was still suffering from kryptonite poisoning, so he was more functional, but or it was more like it was like a short term charge, but like a buzz that he got off the sun. But because he was so damaged, that it wasn't that it was going to wear off, and then he would need the more prolonged rest period to be able to move beyond the poisoning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it makes sense that they would start a power level off at this level, because one of the key aspects of Superman is that he keeps pushing himself to meet any obstacle. So if you had him moving planets in this movie, then it's like, well, where do you go from there? You know, how is Superman going to push himself to go any further after he's already moved planets? Like, it's just kind of, it's a moot point at that point. So you start him at a more reasonable level where it's like, oh yeah, Superman can get punched and beat up and whatnot. And yes, granted, it's, you know, himself most of the time, but even the engineer did some damage.
For sure. For sure. And to be very clear, I do want to see stupid super feats like him moving planets in the future, because we've never seen ridiculous comic level, comic accurate super feats on the big screen. And I want that because it just adds to the comic bookness of the universe. By the way, one of my favorite 3-issue arcs of all time in Action Comics happened when Superman, just for sheer boredom, flew so far into the future that he reached a point where Earth had been long abandoned and was about to be swept up by a cosmic janitor that just gets rid of dead husks of planets. He didn't want that to happen to the Earth, so he cut it in half, turned it inside out, resealed it together, and then blew with his super breath a new atmosphere onto it. I want to see that bullshit in the movies. I don't care.
I'm not clamoring for that story. I'll take DC 1 million, but I don't necessarily need that story.
Oh, man. But regardless. All right. Sorry. We talked about the power level. What else?
Ultraman.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the critiques that I've heard from the Howler Monkeys online, I mean the Snyder fans, was that this Superman kills because he killed Ultraman. And also the kaiju, which Superman definitely didn't kill the kaiju. So like that right there is like, okay, well, you didn't see the movie, so your point is invalid. But the idea that Superman killed Ultraman, it's very, very nebulous, because all he did was push him so that he flew into the black hole. Now, I mean, it's another Superman, so it's difficult for me to believe that that's going to kill him. And I'm sure that in a movie or two, he'll be back as Bizarro. Black hole will probably have taken its toll.
A wormhole effect into another universe or something like that. Yeah. Who
knows? Yeah. Or even like a pocket dimension within the pocket dimension, and you know, it'll, you know, I don't know, crush him and straighten him out and crush him and straighten him out, and then he'll have like traditional Bizarro looks, and it'll have driven him crazy, and they'll be talking backwards and everything. But I don't think that character is gone for good. And even if he is, like, again, it's still a nebulous ending. You don't know what's going on in a black hole. So I do like the fact that James Gunn gave us the monkeys, though. I see so many Snyder fans like just trying to deride this movie over and over again, and people just post pictures of the monkeys, and it's like, yeah, what you're saying is, you know, it's irrelevant. We don't care.
Yeah.
Love that.
I love it. Mark?
Kind of hard to follow up on that one. Thanks, guys. Good night, everybody. I mean, the monkeys thing was rumored for the longest time. So was that really? I think actually from people who had seen the movie, I think there was something out there that had been confirmed that was actually that was going to be in the movie. But it's not like he actively tried to kill. I mean, he didn't have that much of a choice to begin with. He was running out of time, even, you know, they had to solve the bigger problem of everything splitting friggin' apart, thanks to Lex making his pocket dimension because he just has to screw around with stuff. See, Dr. Doom would have done a better job with that. I don't know. I think it was like, it's like he just threw him and it was just the, it's not like he dropped him. Like I'm trying to use the best analogy. It's not even as blatantly obvious as in Batman Begins with the Ra's al Ghul thing. I don't have to save you. it's like, what are you going to do at the end of the day? Now, yes, plus it leaves it vague. We know it's vague. I mean, the whole premise of, you know, if anyone's going to survive going into a black hole, it would be Superman anyway. So that's pretty much what's going on here. So I'm just trying to think any other major things.
Comic logic with death. If you don't see a body, they're not
dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you think, Mark, the monkeys made me think it just the sheer ridiculousness of it, of like, you know, him having like this whole host of them who have been altered in some way or just have a cap or whatever. It just opens up the universe even more because, you know, we have characters like Detective Chimp and the Brain and Monsieur Mala and Ultra Humanite and Gorilla Grodd and all this other stuff in the universe. Like, let's just throw in the idea of intelligent apes in some way, shape or form. So why not? We're introducing everything else in this universe. Why the hell not? So I'm just I am as equally excited about the potential this film offered for whatever comes next to be what I said I wanted a while back when we were just talking about, you know, hopes for this movie as opposed to the reality of it, of just bringing the sheer absurdity of the DC universe to life and just fully embracing it. This movie did that.
Yeah, I would say that it does kind of encapsulate that. I would say that. It gets the ball rolling well, and I guess that was the key, and I think that ultimately was, which is one of the reasons why, regardless of how much money this movie ends up making or not making it, when it's all said and done, that it did pass the basic smell or litmus test, which was people generally had to like the world that they were creating, and they had to, generally speaking, be happy with the movie, even if there were things you didn't like about it. But you, like I said before, it's a nice place to be regardless, as opposed to, you know, that dark cesspool that pretty much was the Snyderverse, where everything was gloom and doom. And even like a character, I mean, even a character like Barry, that was kind of like he's got a lot of baggage in his background too. But, you know, obviously the way he was being portrayed, he was just kind of so dumb and goofy for the most part that even that character was just couldn't escape the darkness at all in the DCEU. So I think this does get the ball rolling. And now we don't have to wait that much longer for Lantern. So let's see what that's going to be like. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
No, I liked it. I also, another moment in the movie I really, really enjoyed and, you know, got a big smile, nearly clapped. The moment where he saves the woman with the building, holds it and lets her drive off, and then she looks back at him coming up front of the dust.
Our Gotham reference.
Yeah.
On the bridge. There was a Gotham City reference on the sign on the bridge.
Catching that look at him in her rearview mirror and smiling or nodding with gratefulness or whatever, that was awesome.
That wasn't any better than him saving the dog or the squirrel, though. Come on, Chad.
I don't know about, yeah, the squirrel moment was, oh God. Remember all the rumors? It's like, it's Chip. Yeah. Oh, we're going to get a Green Lantern squirrel. It's like, no, he saved a squirrel. Of course he did.
Yeah, that was a nice touch.
Any other closing thoughts? Observations?
Yeah, there's always something we're going to miss. I'm just trying to think if there was...
Yeah, if this is the tone he's going for this universe and with this film, and I haven't seen...
Oh, the robots, Jim. Don't you want to talk about the robot?
Oh, yes. Oh,
go
yeah.
But go ahead. I just didn't want us to... That just popped into my head. Okay.
Yeah, if this is the tone he's going for in this film, and I haven't seen Creature Commandos, but if it's similar-esque or whatever, I will say, in terms of Lanterns, what we see with Guy... And what we see with the tone of this universe, I have more, I don't know, restored, not by 100%, but I have more hope and anticipation for what Lanterns will be.
Well, James Gunn has come out specifically and said that every project will have its own tone.
Mm-hmm.
So... the tone of Superman won't necessarily be the exact same tone of anything else. Now, it's the same universe, so there will be aspects of the tone, but you shouldn't expect Superman-type tone with everything else, just to manage expectations.
Yeah, setting up the universe, I guess I meant, as opposed to tone.
Yeah.
The universe this offers makes me a little more... anticipatory of Lanterns.
Yeah. As far as the robots, Alan Tudyk, he's playing K2SO again, but it was fantastic. It was just very, very funny. I like him as a sarcastic robot character.
And what a great character arc going from championing the mechanical nature and the unfeeling nature of them to crying the blues because he wants to be Gary. I'll call you Gary. Thank you.
I feel like he doesn't want to be called Gary. I feel like that's a slight at the name Gary. I thought it was slight for his name. Yeah, so is Gary. And nobody wants that name.
I don't think that's how he said it. He was longing for a name, which is why Clark gave him a name at the end. Because he pointed out, well, four is a name. It's like... but it's good to see that the robots who were so amazingly trash in way too simple fashion were able to come back again, which is what you would expect, because you know the history in the comic books that those robots do tend to get wiped out pretty quickly.
Oh yeah, they're definitely red shirts in Superman stories.
Yeah.
But but they got better.
Yeah, they did get better.
I'm not dead yet. I feel happy. Sorry. I watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail recently.
Mark, we made it through the entire episode and he never referenced it once.
I told you that wasn't going to happen. Let's see if you can lead him into it for a few seconds. We have a little bit of time, so it's not like we can name that tune in three hints. It's like...
No, I thought, Jed, that knowing you and the kind of things that you notice in DC movies and television shows, I was surprised that you didn't have to shout out the fact that there were a couple of things that they did show in this movie.
Oh, Cat Grant's tits bouncing up and down?
No!
Just kidding.
They didn't really show those well, but...
For the record, everybody playing along at home, if you're not on social media as much as I am, it's basically become a meme at this point, and everybody's like talking about, you know, in their comments. If you go to comments threads about Superman related stuff or people posting reviews or whatever, you'll see a comments that's usually highly upvoted, but that Cat Grant scene though, or something like that.
And she looks so much better as a blonde. I rarely ever say that about anybody, but actually seeing her normally and then seeing her in that outfit, it's like, yeah, that's a much better look.
What are you referring to specifically, Jim?
Well, specifically, where did they go and get coffee?
Oh, Jitters. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And Big Burly Burger.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. All that stuff. I did notice that, but yeah, there's so much to focus on in this movie in terms of reviewing it that I.
You let me down, Chad. I'm just saying.
I already talked about all the stuff they introduced in the world building and stuff. Like, you know, Mark had to bring up the Gotham reference. So.
See, it's funny because it was close to coming out before, because when we were talking about things we hadn't talked about yet, and the bridge thing is one of those, when we were talking about saving people. But before that, the bridge thing was in my head, and then we kind of segued out of it. But then when you kind of came back in when we were talking about opening the door to talk about the squirrel and saving the other dog, it's like, oh, now I got to remember to go back and mention the bridge thing, because that was a nice little, very easy to overlook if you're not paying attention, world building moment, just to let you know that, hey, yeah, they're referring Gotham City, is it's on the other, it's the other turn off on the left lane, I think, was Gotham City.
Yeah, the world building and everything was great, and including the minute stuff like references to Jitters and stuff like that. Also, like Stag Industries, the fact that we saw Sapphire Stag, they cast somebody to be Sapphire Stag, and she was on the screen for half a second. But we took the effort to do that. Mm-hmm. That was cool, and the Maxwell Lord of it all as well, because at the very end, because we knew that he was the backer behind the Justice Gang or whatever, but like. We put him on the screen, and we made sure that we showed him in such a light that it's like you can almost, I don't know if this is just my DC knowledge slipping through, but it felt like, you know, like he's taking the place of Lex, the cachet that Lex had before all of his wrongdoing was exposed, has now just shifted over to Maxwell Lord, and he's taking advantage of the spotlight. And he's kind of claiming that space as his own. I love that, you know, as much as it everything that they put in this movie in terms of references to the rest of the DC universe or things within the DC universe was done with what felt like the best intentions, as opposed to just dropping an Easter egg.
Yes.
Because you could have easily just, you know, Metamorpho and he has his son, but, you know, we don't necessarily have to see, you know, him with his wife. We don't have to see that necessarily. We could just assume when he joins the fray that, I don't know, he has someone looking after the kid or whatever, that he has found a safe space for him. We don't have to take the time to show fucking Sapphire Stag on the screen, but they did.
This is true.
There you go.
I definitely want to see it again in theaters. No, for sure.
But you're being forced to watch Ironheart first, Chet. that's the hurdle you must clear in order to see Superman again.
It was also a cool experience because I saw it on IMAX to see, because I hadn't seen the entirety of it like on the screen yet, the new Fantastic Four trailer on that big screen. It looked awesome.
One more week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As the MCU quakes like Galactus walking down New York, because if this movie doesn't work, boom!
All right, are we done with Superman?
For now.
I think so.
All right, Jim, you got anything for us that you want to reference or point to? Any projects we don't know about?
No, but my one request would be to Mark, after the credits, to put in the Simpsons quote, and in this room, 1,000 monkeys on 1,000 typewriters that will someday write the greatest novel known to man. Let's see here. It was the best of times. It was the blurst of times. You stupid monkeys.
I will look, Jim. I will make an effort to see if I can find it. Or else I will delete this out and no one will know we even had this conversation.
It'll just be me reciting it for no reason.
I could just cut it and you're quoting it at the end. Succeed.
Why find a YouTube clip and go and extract the MP3 data when you did it all just for him?
That's right.
Fair enough.
You want to bring us to a close?
I guess. LanternCast@gmail.com. The website is lanterncast.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter. Like us on Facebook, hashtag Geocast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
So long.
A thousand monkeys working at 1,000 typewriters. Soon, they'll have written the greatest novel known to man. Let's see. It was the best of times. It was the blurst of times. You stupid monkey! You shut up.